including the cord by Andrew Meyer, Calvin Balloon, Delaware North. I have reserved 3 minutes to vote. As a preliminary matter, I'd like to note that our firm's managing partner, Robert Dubin, intends to argue this case this morning, but he's hospitalized this week.
Thank you. Thank you.
The facts of this case are very simple, guys. In 1993, plaintiff appellee filed a wrongful discharge and age discrimination action against aluminum sculpting at Delaware North Company. Plaintiff was represented by the Cleveland law firm of Spangenberg, Shipley, and Ryder in that action. Aluminum sculpting at Delaware North were represented by Dubin, Scott, and Hutt. At the trial level, plaintiff was represented by Michael Pearson and another attorney from the Spangenberg law firm. At the trial stage, the defendant at Delaware North was dismissed on summary judgment, and the defendant, the aluminum smelting and refining company, was dismissed after a one-week trial by directed verdict by the judge.
We're familiar with the facts in brief, and I wanted to ask you, it seemed to me that your client's objection, first let me ask you, is it your client's position or your, in this case, that there are no Chinese wall can be used in this sort of scenario?
It's the opposite, Your Honor. In our particular case, Mr. Pearson came to work for our firm 4 months after the decision of the trial court.
Right.
And before he came to work for our law firm, we erected a Chinese wall. In fact, we went through an extensive attempt to erect a Chinese wall as humanly possible. We did all the things that the cases we cited you say you ought to do in order to accomplish the Chinese wall. This case really boils down to a case of first impression in the Supreme Court. As we acknowledge, Mr. Pearson cannot be involved in this proceeding because under law, it's well established, there is a presumption of shared competence. And obviously, this court and the bar would want to preserve the issue of the confidentiality of the client competence. But we do not believe that the presumption of shared competence is irrebuttable. It is the position of Mr. Cowell that presumption is, in fact, irrebuttable, and no matter what we did, we would be disqualified from representing our client for many, many years. We are suggesting to you that that is not the rule, but if, in fact, we have done the right things, that we should not be disqualified from representing our client in this case.
In your brief, take the position that is precisely what motivated the Court of Appeals, which the Court of Appeals took the view that it was an irrebuttable presumption of the shared competence. Is that the only reading one can make of the disqualification by the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, it would be difficult to come up with any other explanation, since briefs were filed and all we got as an explanation of the decision was a postcard that said that the motion to disqualify us was granted.
Could it be that one of the elements is that there is a showing of a hardship by the firm to be disqualified? It was fairly meager argument to the Court of Appeals about the hardship. Could that be?
It would be hard for us to give you an answer to that because if the judge had done an analysis, the court had done an analysis of what the decision was based upon, we would be in a better position to argue with that issue today as to whether or not we had been able to establish the hardship and whether we had been able to establish the Chinese wall. Unfortunately, all we have is a postcard, and the postcard tells us that we've been disqualified.
This court can affirm a lower court for any reason. It doesn't have to be the reason that the court used.
That's correct, but we believe that we would have met the standard of establishing a hardship in this particular case had that issue been analyzed and given the opportunity to go forward. We've had a long-standing relationship with Delaware North and with aluminum smelting that goes back, in my experience, almost 2 decades. Our law firm is the law firm that drafted the summary judgment motion, which the court granted this dismissing Delaware North. Our firm, in fact, one of the top litigators in the state of Ohio, recovered, represented Moon Smelting in the trial of this case that took well over a week, or at least a week to trial. And Mr. Hubbard was, in fact, able to convince the judge, based upon that record and all of his pretrial work, that this case should be dismissed on a direct verdict.
Well, counsel, we see in this courtroom, regular basis, people whose liberty interests affect their life at stake, and they are represented by different counsel than the counsel who tried the case. That regularly happens.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I recognize that in criminal cases that does in fact happen. I'm simply suggesting to you that in a case such as this, that the client, while a client like Mr. Calla has a legitimate interest in having his confidences not shared with his opponent's counsel, our clients have a legitimate interest in being represented by counsel of their choosing. And we think that when you engage in that countervailing argument, it brings you back to the issue of whether or not there's a rebuttable presumption of shared confidences. And if, in fact, you can therefore meet the test of showing both hardship and the creation of a Chinese wall, or what other courts have called the appropriate screening mechanisms to ensure that in this case, Mr. Pearson was not in any way involved in the process, and that the world and the public and Mr. Calla could be assured that any confidences that he gave to Mr. Pearson would not be shared with other members of our firm, that our firm should not be disqualified. In this case, I don't think, the reality is there's never been an argument made by our opponents that the Chinese wall that was created has not been effective. I mean, their argument essentially is that no matter what we have done, we should be disqualified. In this particular case, before Mr. Pearson was actually hired by our firm, we took an inventory of all matters that we had with the Spangenberg law firm, and so that we would know what issues and what cases might be impacted. Mr. Pearson and all our attorneys were instructed not to discuss any of those matters.
Counsel, that all is in your brief where Chinese law. I want to ask you, Pearson was the main attorney representing Calla, correct?
I'm not sure that that's entirely correct, but he certainly was one of them.
That's the main representation. Why isn't there now equal hardships created on Calla? Because he now has to get a new attorney or someone else in the firm to come up to the shop. And he has to do all those things because he lost his attorney to your client that you would have to do if you got off that case.
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that the firm that represented him below still represents him, and it was.
But if he's the main one doing the work, it's no different in reality, even though the name may be on the letterhead, the amount of work somebody knew would have to do in that firm is really no different in reality.
Well, that may be true, and I can't speak to the. Obviously, I'm not in their firm, so I can't speak to how much work Mr. Pearson did on this particular case vis-a-vis other attorneys of the firm. But clearly, the firm was involved, and the firm is going to remain involved. We are suggesting the same thing on our side. Mr. Pearson will not be involved, but there's no reason why our firm should not be allowed to be involved. And in this case, Mr. Hubbard, who actually tried the case, is still available to try this case. He is still their attorney of record in the court on the appeal. And it just seems to us that if there is any equity, and I recognize this is a much more important case than simply a question of equity, it's a question that will obviously apply to other attorneys in similar situations in the future.
But if you create a hardship for the other side by hiring away their counsel, isn't there some lack of equity there?
Well, I'm troubled by the concept of us creating a hardship by hiring away their attorney. This is not a situation where we went out there to destroy this man's case by hiring an attorney.
But you have to think of the consequences of what you do, even though that's never been your intention.
We're involved in a fairly specialized area of the law, and so the number of places that somebody who actually engages in that specialty might be able to go is obviously fairly limited. And in this case, Mr. Pearson, for his own reasons, decided that we were the right place for him at that particular moment in his life. I think that would create a hardship on the bar. Recognizing today that it is commonplace in practice, unlike when I graduated 20-some-odd years ago, when people started with a firm and stayed there forever, today lawyers change firms all the time. If of shared competence is every time we had a situation where an attorney changed law firms. I think that would create a hardship on the part.
Do you think that the appearance of impropriety should have any consideration in this case?
Well, we recognize that the disciplinary rules and the canons deal with the issues of appearances of impropriety, but we believe that if you can actually create a Chinese wall, if you can do the kinds of things that we did, that there is no appearance.
That Chinese wall, though, has to really overcome the appearance of impropriety. Here you've taken your adversary's attorney, hired him in your firm, and that does create an appearance of impropriety. Would you address that?
Well, I will accept that.
I mean, you just say that you've created a Chinese wall. Does that really overcome the idea of appearance of impropriety?
Well, if it doesn't, then you have to accept the concept of the presumption being a rebuttal. We did everything that the cases in the 7th, the 8th, the 11th Circuit, the states of Delaware and Texas, and everyone else who's considered it and found in favor of a rebuttal presumption to do. We obviously did the research before we engaged what we did. It isn't that we left any stone unturned. We read all those cases. We did what those cases said you had to do in order to create it. This state, this court, had no rule at the time that we were dealing with. We did everything we could. What we did have is a Sixth Circuit case, which tells us, which is what this court generally looks for guidance in cases of first impression when you're dealing with issues of conflict of interest and disqualifications. We looked at the Sixth Circuit case. We tried to abide by the Sixth Circuit case, the Manning case. We met all the standards.
Counsel, it appears to me that you went through an awful lot of trouble to get Mr. Pearson. Mm-hmm. Is he such a valuable lawyer in your community that you would go through all this trouble to hire him at the time that this case was pending? Couldn't, if he's that valuable and that important to your firm, couldn't he have been waited? Couldn't he have waited to hire this person after the case was over?
Well.
Because the,
I'm
with Justice Resnick. The appearance of everything that you went through to get Pearson there appears that he was brought to your firm for one reason.
Well, clearly we hired Michael Pearson and we hired many other lawyers, and hopefully they hired me because we thought he was A, available, and B, wanted to practice law in one of the premier firms in the
but
state.
But you told us you set up all these things before you hired him.
Exactly.
Is that correct? So you knew that this problem was going to come up and was probably going to be raised by the other side.
Well, we actually hold the opposite. We actually recognized that there was a possibility that it would be brought up. We recognized that in other jurisdictions that have addressed this issue, including in our view even in Ohio, where the Board of Commissioners has addressed it, has rejected or denied the adoption of an irrebuttable presumption.
I think
at all those situations.
Not a possibility that this problem would come up. It was a surety because you took extreme lengths to make sure that when this problem did come up, which it did, you would have an answer for it.
Well, I guess that is one way of looking at it. I would prefer to look at it as saying that if we could persuade the Spangenberg firm and their client that we had done all the right things by creating the Chinese wall.
Did you discuss it?
Did you discuss it
with them?
We actually told them in advance of hiring Mr. Pearson all the activities we had engaged in. Mr. Hutton, a named partner in our firm, spoke at length with the principal of the firm of Spangenberg, told them all the things we were doing.
So that there were open discussions with the firm, they had no objection.
Well, I can't say they didn't have objection. They obviously now have filed, but at the time it was going on, they had no objection.
No, at the time the discussions were going on, the Spangenberg firm expressed no objection to you at all.
At the time it was going on, they did not file a motion to disqualify. He said it wasn't.
That isn't what you're not answering my question. In the discussions that you had with the Spangenberg office, did they convey to you any problem with this transfer?
I was not privy to those discussions. I can't.
No one told you about these conversations?
I can honestly say that nobody told me about those conversations.
Well, why did you have them then?
Well, I know that a named partner in our firm had those discussions with the Spangenberg firm.
And he kept all that information to himself?
No, he obviously had those discussions with them for the purpose of assuring the Spangenberg firm that their confidences would not be shared among other lawyers, that we were doing everything we could to protect against those confidences being shared.
Did he come back and say, well, there's not going to be any problem with Spangler's office?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I really don't know.
What do you mean you can't answer that?
I don't know the answer. I mean, the reality is that the plaintiffs in this action filed for extensions of time at the appellate level prior to the filing the actual brief. They never filed to disqualify our firm at that time. It wasn't until several days before their last and final extension that they moved to disqualify us.
So this came as a surprise to you?
It was a surprise to the people that were trying this case at the time.
But not to you?
Well, I wasn't involved in the case, Your Honor, so I can't speak to that.
If we accept that you have established a Chinese wall, and the evidence, at least in the briefs, appears they would know that, but you would, what you've done has been pretty extensive. And if we, in fact, affirm here, does that make the presumption of shared confidences, disqualification of attorneys, irrebuttable?
It appears to us, Your Honor, that that's the only reason that the court below made the finding, and that this court were to affirm that judgment, that would be the logical conclusion of anybody who would be reading the record.
So from then on, any time there was this kind of an arrangement, under any circumstances, it would be that the firm, the receiving firm, was clearly
barred.
We've sort of talked around this in several cases. The Morgan case, I think, is one that we mentioned, and we look to the Manning case, the Sixth Circuit. Contrast the Sixth Circuit case for me, the Manning case.
Okay, I know some of my time's up.
You may answer the question.
The Manning case obviously involved a situation, a very convoluted situation of banks and bondholders and the like. And the court went to great lengths to talk about the fact that if you, in fact, create an appropriate Chinese wall, and there was one issue in that, a secondary issue in that, is whether or not the Chinese wall had been affected, whether or not there had been the same firm and actually represented both sides of that particular transaction at the time. That's not an issue in our case. There's no question that our firm has never represented the plaintiffs in this action.
So is it fair to say the Manning case established that it's not an irrebuttable presumption?
The Manning case stands for the proposition.
Okay. Where would we look to find that it is an irrebuttable presumption? Any other state or any
circuit? Already outside the state of Ohio and outside many states that we cited to you. The only states that were cited to you by our adversaries, I believe, in New Jersey and in Florida. The reality is that we cited just cases out of Texas, Delaware, Minnesota, the Seventh Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, all of which stand for the proposition that the presumption of shared confidence is in fact rebuttable. And I think that once you reach that conclusion in this case, or establish that for the bar of the state of Ohio, that we have met all the standards that the Manning case and the other cases that we cited to you establish for meeting the test, both hardship and the Chinese wall.
Thank you.
For the reasons that I've stated, if I might just conclude, Your Honor, we believe that our law firm ought not to be disqualified, and the decision of the Court of Appeals ought to be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Madden. Mr. Madden, let me start you with a question. And it picks up on Justice Douglas's questions. If we adopt the view, and I think we have to discount whatever the Court of Appeals did here, but we have no idea why they decided the case the way they did with this postcard decision, which I find not a very good practice, frankly, in a case like this, where it seems to me you all deserve, and we deserve, to have the benefit of the Court of Appeals' written opinion on an issue such as this. But if we're writing the law in this area, doesn't our adoption of the argument that there should be an irrebuttable presumption here fly in the face of everything we say about honesty of the lawyers representing and our confidence that if a law firm does what Dubin says they did here and taking all the precautions they did, doesn't irrebuttable presumption fly in the face of our confidence that lawyers are honest about these sorts of things?
Exactly correct, Your Honor. That's why I frankly have never used this term in my motion to disqualify the Court of Appeals or any of the briefs that I've submitted to this court on an irrebuttable presumption. I'm not asking for that because I recognize that this court's decision has to be governed on a case-by-case basis. I ask this court to apply the standard that it's applied to numerous disqualification opinions that it has rendered in the past, and that is the appearance of impropriety. We absolutely have the appearance of impropriety.
Well, but appearance of impropriety here, if Duvin did what they said they did in taking all these precautions, I think their argument is that that overcomes any appearance. I mean, at some point you overcome the appearance of impropriety, do you not? I mean, I hope we can do that.
If Mr. Pearson had merely shaken hands with Mr. Collins in our law firm, never worked on his file, never covered pre-trial, never really had any notion of what the file was about, and then Mr. Pearson went to Duvin Pond and didn't work in the case, but was simply photographed, I wouldn't ask to disqualify them. I don't think that would be appropriate. But we don't have that situation here. We have the lead attorney. Mr. Pearson was the lead attorney who exclusively represented Mr. Collin from September of 1993 through January of 1996. And I need to correct a few points that Duvin Pond made about the fact, because they're very important. First of all, Mr. Pearson began his employment with Duvin Cog in January of 1996. That was 4 months after the trial of Mr. Cog concluded. However, he was interviewing with Duvin Cog in November and December of 1995. The employment conversation began within a month or two of the conclusion of Mr. Cog's trial.
But your brief seems to, and I asked the question of Mr. Meyer, and that was a mistake. The question's for you. Do you not believe that the law can recognize a Chinese wall scenario?
I believe that Chinese walls can be considered, but we don't have the evidence to assure this court, this public, and particularly Mr. Kala, that those will be effective. And I'd like to show you in your supplement where the contradictions appear that give us great concern.
Well, that's without example. I know that from the brief, it seems like your client's real complaint is that despite the lawyer's duty to hold his client's confidences, your client believes that that won't be true here, that Mr. Pearson will disclose confidence.
Mr. Collins filed a sworn affidavit at page 52 of your supplement, Your Honors, where he's indicated he does not believe that the integrity of these proceedings will be preserved. He does not believe he can receive the verdict.
That's a subjective belief. As a lawyer, we know that lawyers are bound by the ethical duty to hold the client's confidences to themselves. So the fact that your client doesn't believe that his lawyer will do that is really the basis for your appeal here, isn't it?
It goes beyond the client, Your Honor, respectfully. It concerns the entire focus of the public. If the public is given a message from this court that your lawyer today, who encourages you to make full and frank disclosure to make effective representation, can up and take a job at the law firm representing your opponent tomorrow,
there's no evidence here, and never disclose a word of it. That's part of the obligation of a lawyer, to never disclose it. And there's no reason, the client hasn't said that he knows his lawyer has breached his confidence, right? He just believes that it's not, that it will come out somehow, that his lawyer, Mr. Pearson, will breach his ethical duty.
To respond to your question, Your Honor, I need to point to various documents in your supplement. First of all, Duvin Cog makes the claim that they have this sign-in sheet that logs anyone who has access to the Kala file at their offices. Well, there's no evidence of that. It's not in your supplement. Most importantly, though, I would ask the court to look at page 23 of the supplement, actually page 4 of Duvin Cog's brief in opposition to disqualification the first time around. The Court of Appeals really heard this issue twice. They disqualified on May 10th a move to reconsider the Board of Appeals' affirmance on this qualification line. But on page 4 of their initial brief proposing on this qualification, at the bottom of the page, they make this statement, and this is you and Tom Sawyer who made this statement, and I feel it's worth reading verbatim to the court. They wrote, in view of the fact that the trial of these issues has been concluded, it is clear that any issue of client competences is long since passed. That completely eradicates any assurance or comfort that the public or this court or Mr. Collins can take that Mr. Collins' competences are going to be protected and preserved.
Counsel, let me inquire into how you do on one of that, because I think you correctly sense that our concern is too rigid a rule would essentially handcuff lawyers to firms with which they no longer wish to practice and make movement to other firms extremely difficult. And that wouldn't seem to be fair or good for the profession either. But let me ask you, you indicated their discussions began after this trial concluded about a change of employment by Mr. Pearson.
Yes, sir.
At that point in time, did he alert his clients that these discussions were ongoing while he was preparing an appeal for this client? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Did he immediately, once these discussions were initiated, alert his client, now your firm's client, that he was engaged in discussions with the other firm about employment?
That's correct. Your Honor, Mr. Pearson resigned January 1996. That was the first time that Mr. Collins had ever heard Mr. Pearson was going to terminate.
So while he was working on the appeal, he was actually having preliminary discussions about employment with another.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in addition, the 8th Appellate District, as part of its course of appeal, holds a settlement conference before any briefs are filed. That settlement conference was held November 13, 1995. Mr. Collins and Mr. Pearson had a very frank conversation about the propriety of the settlement. Mr. Collins' bottom line, the strengths and weaknesses in this case, the day before that settlement conference. I would also point out that on January 96, that's the first time that this law firm knew that Mr. Pearson was going to go to Duke and Con. Mr. Pearson didn't resign and then begin to interview with Duke and Con. He told us on the day that he was going to Duke and Con that day. If you look at pages 28 and 29 or so, you will see the letter that Mr. Hudson sent to Mr. Weinberg. The first paragraph acknowledges that our law firm, on behalf of Mr. Collins, initiated the discussion that Duke and Con should disqualify themselves. And that is when Mr. Hudson began to say, well, we've done this and done that.
What would be the proper, assume Mr. Pearson had this interest in switching law firms, what would be the proper methodology to handle that?
As this court has done when it's considered disqualifying judges or the judges of an entire county, it should examine whether there is an appearance of impropriety. It should examine the facts. It should examine the representation, the amount of involvement that the attorney has had in representing the former client, and what the size and structure and realities of where his subsequent employment will take.
Well, you wouldn't have any objection if Mr. Pearson went with the other firm after all the appeals in this case were concluded.
Not at all, although the basis of our appeal is to seek a new trial. We believe the record verdict was an error, but at the conclusion of that case, Duke and Con, as far as I'm concerned, can represent aluminum smelting in Delaware North in any case they want today, just not one where Mr. Collins is involved, because Mr. Pearson is now employed with it. And Mr. Collins, as I've indicated in the brief, and I won't repeat the brief from the court, I've already read it, but he had access to every potential competence that Mr. Collins could possibly have. And there is just no way that the public of this court or Mr. Collins can accept Duke and Con's continued involvement in this case when Mr. Collins' former attorney is over there in a law firm the size of 33 attorneys. They're all litigators.
He's not, I'm trying to separate with you, Mr. Madden, the concept we're talking about here and the particular facts of your case. So conceptually, because we get to the concept and then you say, well, say Mr. Callan can't accept this. he himself, okay, so let's be global here.
Brother Horizon, yeah.
Right, and the idea, I guess you're taking the position, although you're brief only, you're taking the position that as a concept, a Chinese wall would never be appropriate, would not be acceptable, shouldn't be accepted by this jurisdiction, although it is by most of the circuits, it would not be acceptable for a lawyer who was personally involved in the litigation prior to moving.
Deeply involved.
Yeah, that's your concept that you think we should accept. And yet that isn't the case, is it, with the circuits don't make that distinction that you're making. They certainly accept the concept of Chinese walls being not at odds with the concept of appearance of impropriety. They can go hand in hand. You can overcome an appearance of impropriety with a Chinese wall. You would agree that the circuits accept that?
I would agree to the extent that the circuits still do a factual analysis within the willingness to accept that there is a Chinese wall.
I think, isn't that analysis typically to determine whether or not sufficient and appropriate screening devices were in place?
That's part of the analysis, correct.
Now, and then if they find that they are, then it's not at odds for with the concept of an appearance of impropriety to allow a lawyer to move from firms even where he has represented the same party.
Well, I can't agree with that conclusion, Your Honor. For example, the Manning decision did not come to that conclusion. The Manning decision remanded the matter back to the trial court to hold a hearing on that very point.
But set forth standards about what are appropriate screening methods that would be acceptable.
Well, the Manning decision was applying the Model Code of Professional Responsibility, not the Ohio Code, but the three factors that they threw out as a suggestion to guide the lower court actually militate against allowing the Lucan to continue in this proceeding. First of all, they said, what is the size of the firm? What are the structural divisions within the firm? The Dubin-Con firm is a 33-attorney firm. That's a small environment where Mr. Pearson is going to be working regularly with the other litigators, including those representing Mr. Collins' opponents, on a daily basis. The second criteria is, what is the likelihood of contact between the infected attorney, in this case, Mr. Pearson, and the other lawyers who have access to the file? Well, in that situation, we're all in the Cleveland office, they're all on the same one or two floors, they're going to have daily contact. Mr. Pearson could be working with Mr. Hubbard on other cases. There's a real risk that these conferences or some indications can be made available to the lawyers for Mr. Carlos' opponents.
Counsel, even though you may completely erect a Chinese wall, I think what you're trying to argue is that at some point, even though a Chinese wall is there, the appearance of impropriety is still so strong that it needs to overcome even the Chinese wall.
Absolutely right.
I mean, in this case, you had Pearson negotiating with this firm without disclosure to his client or to your law firm before any Chinese wall went up that you're aware of. You have your client all of a sudden being come out to drive with no attorney who's gone to hold the opposition. We're not talking about reality. When you talk about appearance of impropriety and disclosure on both judges, we aren't saying in reality is the defendant's prejudice. We're saying the public confidence, the appearance requires it. And so I think what you're arguing is the reality may be that it's Chinese wall, but the appearance is still so strong, we need to, under these facts, find a disqualification. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. The appearance of impropriety is not something that this court can allow to continue in this proceeding or any other. The last thing that this court can allow is for the public to have another reason to distrust the legal profession. This court has never required, in any prior disqualification proceeding, proof of actual impropriety. That is an impossible burden for the litigant seeking disqualification to meet. I would have to wiretap or bug or spy around the offices of Dubin Con, potentially then gag, or I have to wait until trial for some confidence to come out for cross-examination or through some other witness, and then I'm stuck. And if I move for disqualification at that point, the court's going to say, well, you waited this long, there can't really be any issue. There is no way if this law firm continue to remain involved in this case, if the public's confidence is to be maintained in the integrity of our judicial proceedings.
Let me change the facts on you slightly. What if this client said to Pearson, you're the person who you're the reason I'm here. If you're changing law firms, you're taking my case with you. You're still my lawyer. What happens at that point?
Well, I'm not sure what happens at Duke and Conn with respect to this.
Well, I mean, they have to do it, but doesn't that then really force a train wreck?
I'm sorry,
doesn't that really force a train wreck? I mean, at that point,
it does, and then of course you have the question of the individual lawyer's ethical obligations. You have a client continue the representation and seem to be excused by the court and so forth. My time is up, Your Honor, but I'd like to answer your comment. No matter what the factual situation, this court is charged with the responsibility of ensuring that where the appearance of impropriety exists, it is addressed and disqualification is appropriate, that it acts swiftly. And it has acted swiftly in the past in previous disqualification opinion. Even where judges, for example, were accused of a prejudicial remark or having a pecuniary interest in the outcome of, say, a state fiasco on the side of the county, there has never been a shred of evidence that the judge actually engaged in the crime.
That is a little different, though, is it not? A judge is an elected official who is constitutionally ordered to be fair and impartial and independent, and while there are some elements certainly in the perception issue with respect to the issue here, it is a little different. I mean, the responsibility of a judge is different than the responsibility of a lawyer in his relationship to a law firm. I wouldn't stretch that one too far, I guess. I don't think you need to, frankly.
But I agree with you, Your Honor. I would make this point because I do agree in large part with what you said. The judge in this state enjoys the presumption to take the fairness and the ability to overcome his personal feelings in the case. Lawyers don't. The public is going to be far more willing to give the judge the benefit of the doubt than they are a lawyer or his law firm. If this court is to say to the judges, there's no evidence he did anything wrong, but in order to preserve the public's confidence in this proceeding, in order to avoid even the mere appearance of impropriety, we are going to ask you to step aside. That is all the more appropriate in a case where you have a law firm that is making assurances that are really contradicted by the evidence you supplement, when you have a lawyer who exclusively represented him for over 2 years and is now working in a very small employment situation.
Let me interrupt, and your time is up, but I'm still a little confused about your position. You said that you didn't think we needed to adopt a rule of law that says there's an irrebuttable presumption, but it seems to me both the propositions of law and your brief do just that, and I'm really concerned about what law we write here in the context of the facts. As you know, proposition law number one is a law firm has a professional responsibility to withdraw from representation when it hires an attorney who represented a party that's involved in a continuing lawsuit against the party represented by the hiring law firm. There's no condition there, it seems. That looks like irrebuttable to me. Is it not? Or?
Well, the standard that Duke and Conn is claiming that we're making, or not, the standard that they're saying not to adopt and I'm not proposing, is an irrebuttable presumption of shared competence. The basis of our expectation that they would disqualify themselves is because there is the appearance of impropriety. That's, and my motion to disqualify is in the supplement. That is the basis on which I asked the appellate court to disqualify this law firm. And to answer Justice Cook's concern, yes, it was a two-sentence opinion, but there was no reference in anything that I described to the court of an irrebuttable presumption. So I think we can eliminate that as the basis for the Court of Appeals order of disqualification. In actuality, the court in all likelihood decide the case based on the appearance of impropriety, which is the basis of the motion for disqualification filed and also the basis of argument.
Under the standards you're setting up, wouldn't it always be an appearance of impropriety?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So it becomes an irrebuttable presumption?
Yeah, that's right.
It does, and if that is the case, and the court is doing its job of making sure that the public's confidence in the proceedings are preserved.
So what are we, go ahead.
You really want us to draw the fine line and the bright line that any time this happens, the receiving firm can't do anything. You know, I don't want to personalize this, but since we've taken more time than we should, I want to tell you what's bothering me, and maybe you could answer that, and maybe...
Oh, yeah.
When I was reading these briefs, it occurred to me that your firm has, maybe still does, represents a number of people in the Dr. Burt Love surgery case. As I was reading it, I was wondering what would have happened had somebody from the hospital involved, whatever hospital was, I think over in Dayton, with the downsizing where they were doing, a lawyer there decided to go to work in a medical malpractice firm, or a firm that does medical malpractice, and chose your firm and you chose him. Is there any way you could continue to represent all that class of women who were mutilated by the doctor?
It would be incumbent upon the hiring law firm to weigh very carefully whether or not that hiring decision was proven in light of the severe consequences of portended.
All I'm asking is there any way to have over... You know what I'm asking.
Yes, sir. I
very heavily.
The Cardona thing would indicate that no, there is not.
Okay. So you do want an irrebuttable presumption.
Based upon these facts, as the question that I asked you earlier, there would be no appearance, or the Chinese wall could overcome any appearance of impropriety if the case was concluded.
Correct.
So we have to look at these facts, so it isn't really an irrebuttable presumption we're talking about.
That's correct.
Rebutted.
Except that your statement of law is a rebuttable presumption. I mean, there's a difference between whether we decide the case on its facts here without saying as a matter of law adopting Cardona, or whether we adopt all the other courts that have gone the other way, isn't it? I mean, we have a choice. We can say irrebuttable presumption if something like this happens, or something even less, the facts are less specific, that there's, you know, there's a perception, and it doesn't matter what the reality is. Perception is so important that we give that precedence over reality. Or we can say, in this case, it looks to us like Dubin was wrong. Isn't now we have a choice. One, we can write law, and the other, we can decide the case on the facts. I think that's our confusion. Is I think that your brief seems to be different, and your statements, you say one hand, it's not irrebuttable, but then when you're pressed, that's really the result, seems to me, what you want, isn't it, or am I wrong?
With these facts, I believe the court's conclusion is really an irrebuttable presumption, but the basis for disqualification that we have asserted from the Court of Appeals level all the way through to the present is because of the appearance of impropriety. There is no way that this law firm can continue to remain involved. If the public's confidence, if the court's confidence, if Mr. Carlos' confidence in the integrity of the proceedings is to be preserved.
This is a really important case. I suppose that's the reason we're taking so long with it, because it's going to make real... This is going on all the time, people switching firms. And
I'd like to be part of the show.
I'd like to go just one step further. If we're going to look at that the presumption of impropriety is so great that we can't do anything about it, supposing you win, they're disqualified, first thing their client's going to ask them is, well, what lawyer should we get? That'd be fair? It's probably what'll happen.
That makes sense.
Okay. And they'll say, okay, go down to East 9th Street and see so-and-so. Is there any way that we could ever even think that a Chinese wall was erected, that when that new client comes into that new firm, that they aren't going to at least talk to them? So don't we just have the cascading problem?
Again, we place heavy reliance on the lawyers who are subsequently retained to honor the ethical obligations that they have as practitioners of the state.
And shouldn't we also give them that presumption?
Your Honor, when you have a lawyer in that law firm still gainful employee who is representative of the Mr. Collins, I don't see how that presumption can be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Madden.
I appreciate the court's time and conclusion to ask that the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, you've used your time, but you may take a minute for rebuttal.
Just wanted to make a couple of brief points. Clearly, the cases cited in the discussion that was held with regard to the appearance of proprietors, police, and judges, obviously, is an absence of a case such as this. We're not dealing with a decision maker. Judges are decision makers. We may accept the fact that the public needs to believe that decision makers are fair and impartial. We're advocates.
Counsel, if Kyle had said, Pearson, you've been with me from day one. You're my lawyer. If you're changing law firms, I'd love you, but I still want you on this case. Does the Chinese, I mean, then your firm's got to make some decisions. Is there any way, I mean, it would be your position that even in that circumstance, Pearson can say to his client after he comes over, I can't handle you, and you can use this Chinese wall and still go on with your client, or wouldn't you have to bail with your client?
Well, if Mr. Pearson clearly cannot represent the client, there's no question about that, we accept that. The client doesn't only give an employer, has a right to make a decision in life also whether to accept the client. If he says, I have to give you up under these circumstances, but I promise you I will not do anything to jeopardize your confidences, and then we create the Chinese wall, that, in our view, would be sufficient.
So you could go right on, even though you've got the other side out there saying, hey, they swiped my lawyer, right? In other words, his view could not necessarily relate to the competences. It might be that I had the hottest lawyer going on this subject, and to save the day, they went out and hired him away from me.
Now, obviously those aren't the facts of the case. I guess if those...
Well, we don't know what Kyle thinks of his lawyer. Maybe he does think exactly that. And then doesn't that create a whole other set of...
That becomes issues? A subjective piece that we're going to deal with this issue on an objective basis so that we can set a standard for the bar that will govern lawyers for the future. We can't deal with the subjective. We have to deal with the object. If we adopt the rule, which it seems to me is really what my adversaries are saying, which is that there is an irrebuttable presumption in facts such as this, what we are assuming is we are actually hurting our image in the public rather than helping it. Because what we are doing is we are telling the public that they ought to assume bad behavior on the part of attorneys, that attorneys cannot keep confidences, that the only way to maintain, to protect, so that they can keep confidences, is to say that they can't be involved.
Well, let's make it a little less complicated. I mean, couldn't we just assume that you have to sit down with your client and say, our law firm had an opportunity to get what we thought, and then after your trial, even though we won and he lost, we were really impressed with this young man. We've had an opportunity to hire him, and we're going to take advantage of that opportunity. But that means that because his client is now at sea without his lawyer, we're required by the rules that govern lawyers to have you use another lawyer for appeal, and there are several good ones, and here's who we strongly recommend to you, and we'll hold hands with that lawyer, and you'll have the file and all of that.
I would ask the same question that Justice Douglas asked. Wouldn't that then create the same potential impropriety if we held hands with the other law firm? The reality is that if we assume that lawyers are not going to engage in bad behavior, if we want to send a message to the public that lawyers are trustworthy, that the message that we always try to make sure that people understand, we have to assume that lawyers are going to be trustworthy unless there's evidence in a case that they haven't been. And in this case, there is absolutely no evidence that our law firm has been anything but trustworthy. We created a Chinese wall. The specific answer to your question is, if I was sitting in New Jersey or Florida at the time that this case came up, I may have had to sit down with my client and say, I have to withdraw under those circumstances. But I was sitting in Ohio where the Board of Commissioners had rejected the issue of an irrebuttable presumption, where the Sixth Circuit, which this court normally looks to for guidance, had also, in fact, rejected the irrebuttable presumption, where all the circuits had rejected the irrebuttable presumption. We wouldn't have had any reason to sit down with our clients under these circumstances. We have had reason to believe we could have stayed.
And every one of those circumstances involved a lawyer coming over who had been the lead attorney on the case.
Had been an attorney with significant involvement in the case, at least. And cases where the courts have gone the other way are essentially cases where there have been some evidence of an impropriety. Even in the Manning case, when the case was remanded to the lower courts for consideration, one of the reasons it was remanded is there was some indication that the same law firm had represented both sides of the lawsuit at some point in time, and that could not have been, and we would acknowledge that could not have been. And they were simply asking the lower court to make a judgment about whether those facts actually existed. But they set forth the standard very clearly that the absence of that, there is a rebuttable presumption if you can show the hardship and the Chinese wall, and we have, in all honesty, Your Honor, done everything humanly possible to show hardship and Chinese wall. If in fact the court were to find that we have to be disqualified, they would be setting down a guideline for the bar of this state that there is an irrebuttable presumption of shared confidences, and they would then be going, in my view, to the minority view, where in this case there is no evidence that we have done anything whatsoever wrong. In fact, we went over backwards and did everything that the cases suggested you ought to do to preserve those shared confidences. We submit to this court that the decision of the Court of Appeals for the Eighth District should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.